I got back in the gym again, dusted off the Lycra and got back in there and loved it. Always loved just the feeling of being strong.
Welcome to The Greg Bennett Show. I'm your host, Greg Bennett, and this was a very special conversation with a longtime friend. I can't believe it's been over 30 years with Craig Alexander. In this episode, we discuss his journey that he's been on the last 18 months with his 13, now going on 15-year-old son, Austin, the amazing scare they went through and the journey since and the recovery process. Not an episode to be missed. A very deep and authentic Crowie shares the story and describes it in pictures like only Crowie can. A really, really great episode. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. If you love the episode, please share it. If you're enjoying the show, would love a review and some five-star ratings wherever you can. But I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. And remember, success comes to those who endure just one moment longer. Right. Today's guest, well, he's a legend in the world of triathlon, a legend whose name echoes across the Ironman World Championships with three Kona Ironman victories, two 70.3 World Championships to his credit, an absolute monster in the world of triathlon. Beyond the finishing lines and podiums, he's a dedicated family man and a seasoned coach and a mentor to many in the sport. From his early days in Cornell to standing atop the world in Kona, his journey has been one of relentless pursuit, mastering the world of triathlon. Today, we're going to dive deep into not just his thoughts on the world of triathlon, but also a personal story that's touched his family deeply and has required enduring resilience from all involved. So without further ado, welcome back to a good mate of mine. It's been too long, and thanks for joining me once again on the Greg Bennett Show, Craig Alexander. How are you, mate?
I'm very good, Greg. How are you?
I'm all right, mate. 6 a.m. in Sydney. Once again, you must love me for these calls.
Oh, mate, I'm an early riser, so you can't old habits die hard, so.
Mate, well, I appreciate you. How things are with you, mate? I saw you did a 25K the other day up in Noosa. You're still running pretty well.
No, I'm not running well.
Are you 50 now?
Yes, yeah, I'm 51 this year. I turned 50 last year. So I
happy birthday.
Yeah, I still get quite a few event ambassador roles, and that one is a good one because, as you know, Noosa's kind of like the spiritual home of triathlon in Australia. They've got the triathlon there that's been going decades. It's kind of like an epicenter now for training. A lot of international athletes set up camp there and a base there. Of course, you and Laura trained out of there, and a lot of world-class not only triathletes but swimmers. There's a world-class swim squad there. And there was an ultra-trail event put on, and I was asked to be an event ambassador. And it kind of made sense because I was still doing a little bit of running, and a lot of that was on trails around here where I live in southern Sydney. And even when I was training for triathlons, I did quite a bit of running on the trails. Certainly not a lot of the hard technical running that those trail races are known for and the really, you know, amazing trail runners. They have this technical proficiency on the single tracks and rock hopping and all that sort of thing. But I think there was a sort of a big push for triathletes to move across and dip their toe in with some trail running. It's kind of great cross training. I sort of jumped at the role to be the event ambassador, and they had events of all different distances. So I selected to do the 25K. I wasn't brave enough to do the 50 or the 80K.
There
were long ones. And I'm running twice a week. So I thought, there's no way I'm going to be able to get a 50K done. But, you know, the first couple of years I did the race, even off two or three runs a week with that huge sort of base that we developed over the years. It was enough to make it a comfortable experience, but not this year. It was decidedly uncomfortable. I took off the gun goes off and you just go into race mode. Yeah. And I hadn't done a lot of running, especially downhill running. And there was quite a bit of downhill running in this. And as you know, that requires a certain kind of conditioning and a different sort of technique and just an impact on the quads. And I was reduced to a walk on a lot of the downhills in the second half of that run. It was painful, but still
brutal.
Still fun nonetheless.
Have you put on any, like, you still look really lean, you know? Like, I was talking to Dr. Dan Plews, who's been on the show many times, and he set that, you know, age group time that was unbelievable to break 8 hours last
day.
Year.
I was there watching that day. Dan was incredible,
Incredible. But he's put on, he's like, I probably shouldn't be saying, but he's put on a good 10, 12 kilograms since in muscle. Like, he really put on muscle pretty quick. And I said, yeah, me too. You know, I'm up around that 80 kg from race weight at 68, but you still look like you're a whippet, mate. Are you still in that 68? Because remember, you and I used to weigh exactly the same. Yeah. We'd be like 68, 69. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I got the gym bug as well. Especially with Aussie and taking Aussie to the gym so much, my son. Yeah. But when I started in the sport, I was actually 87, 88 kilos. I was bigger. Yeah. My best mate at the time. So I was about 19, 20. It was just before I started doing triathlons. And my best mate who I was going through uni with, he was playing in the NRL. He played for South Sydney. And so he was
rugby league for everyone listening.
Yeah. Rugby league. So, it's our professional, rugby league, competition in Australia. And so he was at the gym five times a week. So I would go with him and, I was big. And then of course, when your body responds to the different stimulus that you apply to it, start doing endurance sports. I got that weight down to about the mid 70s with all the training. And then by the time I'd sort of been in the sport quite a few years and was starting to race more half Ironmans. And then Ironman racing, I got down to 70 and under. So, I sort of got back up to the mid 70s doing a lot of push ups, bench press, chin ups.
You're the same as me, mate.
Yes. But then I guess what interrupted my gym regime was having to sort of get those two or three runs in a week to prepare for the Noosa Ultra Trail. So I shedded some of the extra pounds again. So I think your body finds its sweet spot with whatever you're doing, whatever exercise you're doing. But I've certainly found later in life, I shouldn't say later in life, midlife, I've enjoyed getting in the gym. It's something I did quite a lot as a soccer player and when I was at uni before I started doing triathlons and even later in my triathlon career when I got to my mid to late 30s, I got back in the gym again, dusted off the Lycra and got back in there and loved it, always loved just the feeling of being strong and being able to lift some weight and how your body would respond to that, the different changes, physical changes that I always got a really good response when I got in the gym and it happened relatively quickly. So, yeah, I'm going to have to get back in there. My target was to hit 80.
80s you got. It's funny, I was saying this to Dan the other day when we were chatting. I said I always wanted to retire and then go, right, I'm going to hit the gym and become like a normal man, you know, like
a real man. I want to be a real man.
Yeah, and then I had kids, and I want to be able to throw them in the pool, you know, like be able to. So I hit the gym pretty hard, but I don't want to have to replace my entire wardrobe. And so it's kind of I've kind of gone to one extreme. it is a little bit the money, but it's also just the hassle. I hate buying clothes.
Yeah.
And it's all right if the shirts are, the suit jacket that you might have. I don't have too many blazers and suit jackets, but I have a couple, for you. I don't have to buy new ones of those. I've already had my suit taken out. I'm like, oh.
No, I feel your pain on that because I was the same. I had that nice felt little waistline and I was starting to have to squeeze myself into the pants. I'm like, it's just inconvenient.
Oh, it's inconvenient. I like it. Now, mate, you mentioned, the last couple of years with Ozzy, your son, you've been going to the gym. I want you to take me through what's, happened. And I've been chatting to you on Instagram and bits and pieces, but, it's been an incredible couple of years. And Ozzy he goes to the school I went to, Newington College, which is one of the big GPS schools in Sydney, one of the big schools in Australia, to be honest. And he's there running for them, but take me through, mate, and what's been going on?
Yeah, well, he's at Newington. He's on a dual academic / sporting scholarship. So he's a talented little boy. But 2 years, well, 18 months ago, September the 17th, 2022, we were at the GPS Athletics Championships, which you would know well. You probably ran at.
Yeah.
So we're at the Olympic site in Homebush, the big stadium. So Newington was there with eight other schools. The place was packed. Not only the student athletes were there, but all the student bodies were there from all the schools and parents. So there's probably 10,000 people at the stadium. And, I was really proud of Ozzy because he was mainly playing soccer or football, as I like to call it. But he got picked by the school coach and the athletic season, just for people who aren't familiar with the GPS season, it's a 5-week season. It's a shortened athletic season, but it was...
Wow.
But he really sort of reveled in it. He thrived. It was two running sessions a week with an athletics meet on the Saturday, and it culminated on the last weekend with the GPS Championships. And September the 17th, we went out to Homebush. Felt like any other day, really. He ran his 800 in the morning and ran a PB, just a tick over 220 for the 800. And he got down. I was so proud of him. He got down to a 64, just a touch under 65 seconds for 400 meters, and just over 220 for 800. And we were there watching the 1500. And then some of his teammates who ran the 1500, they finished the race, and he went for a cool down jog with them. And I was standing talking with a good friend of mine's son, who was at St. Joseph's College. He was in year 12, and I also had my two daughters, Lucy and Lani, with me. Neri was in the grandstand. And I just looked over, and I could see a boy in a Newington tracksuit laying on the ground, but there were kids everywhere. There were kids everywhere, kids jumping, rolling around on the grass hill. And I kept looking over at this kid though, and then the kid looked over and he saw it was me, and he got up and tried to walk over, and I saw it was Austin, and he was having trouble walking. So I walked over to him, and he sort of half collapsed again. I caught him and laid him down, and he said he had some. I said, "Oh, what's going on, buddy?" And he said, "I've got this pain in my chest, Dad." And I started thinking, has he had a heart attack? Or, I mean, he's a healthy kid who plays 1,000 different sports. And then I thought, no, you know, don't get ahead of yourself here. So I just sort of sat him down and laid him down. And yeah, he's sort of out of breath a little bit. And then he just sat up and said, "Oh, the pain, like it was a really bad pain." He said, "The pain's gone away." And I said, "Well, mate, just sit here. Let's just gather ourselves," because there were people everywhere. There were doctors, obviously there was medical staff at the stadium. It's a big athletics meet. And Neri, who my wife, who's an emergency nurse, she was in the grandstand. So that wasn't panic stations or anything, but he said, "No, I think I can get up now." So he stood up. And I said, "Well, we'd finished competing for the day. So we were free to go." And I said, "Why don't we walk over and get your gear?" Because the athletes were set up on the back straight. All the rest of the student body and the parents were in the stadium. But all the athletes from all the different schools were set up on the back straight. And I said, "Let's walk over and get your gear, and then we'll go and meet Mum." So he said, "I'm okay, I can go and do it. You can head back, I'll meet you in the stadium." So it started to rain actually, and the girls, everyone cleared out. Lucy and Lani ran back to the stadium, and I sort of walked halfway back and waited. And I could see he was having trouble walking. And so I started getting a little bit worried. Anyway, I called Neri, got Austin. We walked under the stadium to the medical room where there were some doctors and medical staff. And, yeah, they thought he'd just jumped and had some sort of mechanical injury or impact. So they put an ice pack on it. But I could see Neri was concerned straight away because she started asking some questions, sort of neurologic questions. And as you know, Greg, I'd studied as a physio 25 years ago, and one of the actual, coincidentally, one of the placements I did a couple of months at Bathurst Hospital was stroke rehabilitation. And so when Neri started asking certain questions, I knew exactly what she was thinking. Anyway, I said, "Should we call an ambulance?" And we decided just to drive to the hospital. We thought he was rapidly losing lower limb function. So I ran to get the car. Lucy and I ran over. The car was parked a couple of miles away. We ran to get the car, drove it straight into the stadium. By this time, he was in a wheelchair, and I actually tried to get him into the car. But from the time I'd left the stadium to get the car, he was able to stand. But as I got back, I tried to stand him up out of the wheelchair. He had no lower leg movement at all by this time. So I nearly dropped him because I thought he could take his own weight. So I sort of stood him up out of the wheelchair and reached into the car to pull the chair back. And he sort of fell, and I had to catch him. And so he was rapidly losing lower leg function. We jumped in the car. We drove. We were going to go to the Children's Hospital at Westmead because we're at Homebush. And we decided to go to St. George Hospital because that's where Neri used to work. And she said straight away, we're going to need an MRI. And because she'd worked there, we thought we could get in quick. And it was a terrible drive to the hospital. I was in the front. Ozzy was in the passenger seat. Neri and the girls were in the back, stuck in Sydney traffic. And I could see Austin was – he's a really calm – there's a really calm nature, Ozzy, but I could see the fear in his face. And he was sort of holding himself out of the chair like he was uncomfortable sitting. And he started asking us, will I ever walk again? And I'm thinking, well, buddy, I mean, we're on the way to the hospital. And he must have felt something really bad going on inside his body. Anyways, we're driving to St. George Hospital, and Neri couldn't get hold of anyone there. So she rang Sutherland Hospital, which is where she now works, and the doctor answered the phone straight away, knew it was Neri, and said, yeah, bring him straight here. So we just went straight to the Sutherland Hospital. They were waiting for us when we got there. By this time, I had to completely lift him out of the car. He'd lost all function from hips down. I carried him in, put him in. We got him inside. Neri knew everyone there. The staff knew her, so they took him straight in, and I drove the girls home. We just sat around, and Neri actually, we literally got home. We lived probably a mile from the hospital. We got home, and Neri said, pack an overnight bag where we're being transferred to the Children's Hospital at Randwick, which is the big children's hospital in Sydney. She said, you better get up here quick because the ambulance is about to leave. So I raced back up to the hospital. He was being loaded in the back of an ambulance, and they went over to Randwick with the sirens going, I guess, to get through the traffic. But I went back home because obviously we've got two daughters at home still, and I've got to say I was a little worried. I was worried. It's funny, you know, we have all these defense mechanisms and you try and stay calm, and I was worried. Neri was quite calm, but she works in the medical field. I mean, she's an emergency nurse. She sees horrible things every day. So I was just concerned for our son. He looked scared. I was scared. But when I got home, I remember the day well. I got home, and the girls were very quiet when I got home, and I thought to lighten the mood, we started to play Monopoly and just waited for Neri to call. I knew they'd do a lot of testing. And I must say, the more I sat at home with our daughters, the more I remember thinking, no, it's not going to be anything catastrophic or bad. I mean, he's a healthy kid, got to stay positive. And but I must, they say knowledge is power. I think it can also be crippling if you know a lot about a certain field. And I'd studied in the medical field, but it had been a long time ago. So I was just running through my brain of a checklist of things I thought it could be. Anyway, long story short, Neri messaged me at about 6 o'clock that evening. So he collapsed at the track at 1:30 in the afternoon. It's now about 6:30. I'd given the girls, made dinner for the girls, we'd eaten. She said, you better get to the hospital. So I just jumped in the car and drove over to Randwick. And yeah, it wasn't a good scene, really. We're in emergency. He was having some testing done, and we had incredible doctors, I've got to say, from day one. When I walked in, the people at the front door knew I was coming, so they just ushered me straight in. And By now, the level of function that Austin had lost had increased. It was now up to sort of his nipple line or his chest. Whoa. So it was moving up.
Oh, geez.
So it started with his feet and lower legs, and it was now he had no movement below his chest, and lost all function. He had sensation. He could feel you touching him, but he'd lost different types of sensation. So he had no sharp, blunt, hot, cold sensation below his chest, and had no motor function or any function at all from sort of nipple line chest down. So
does that affect the organs?
Yeah,
that
affects
point?
Affect everything.
Yeah.
A lot of things, yes. Yeah. So a lot of the innovation for heart and lungs comes from above,
mm-hmm.
but other organs below, yes, if the neural level that they're innovated by was below, then they were impacted, yeah. So, there's a lot of implications there, bladder, bowel, a few other organs. But we had amazing doctors. The actual head doctor on that night is the head pediatrician in New South Wales, Matt O'Meara, I think his name was from memory, and Neri knew him. She said his main role now is developing policy with politicians. He's so up high in the hierarchy, but he still works two or three shifts a week in emergency, night shift. Mm. And we were lucky that – so we had the head pediatrician in New South Wales was the admitting doctor. They did all the scans. His spinal cord, vertebral column was all intact. So – no neurosurgery was required. He was handed over to neurology straight away. So, we had the first CT scan. We had an angiogram, MRI, and about 1 in the morning, 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, we went into a room with a neurologist, another brilliant man, and he said, look, the MRI's come back negative, meaning nothing is showing up. But he said, if it is what I think it is, that's what we'd expect. We'll do another MRI in 24 hours, and that will show something, I believe. So we said, well, what do you think it is? And he said, from the history, from what I'm seeing on different testing, I think something has blocked blood supply to his spinal cord. And that's what Neri had thought the same thing, because one of the first things they put you on is blood thinners. When you lose function that rapidly, they put you on blood thinners because there's a suspicion of a clot or something blocking blood to blood supply. So he was already on blood thinners by the time we were having this conversation. And on the angiogram, we couldn't see a blood clot. They couldn't see anything, but he'd already been on blood thinners for several hours by the time. I mean, that was one of the first things they did when we first presented to the hospital. So, so that's what he thought. He thought something had blocked blood supply, and it wasn't a good scenario, but we were going to wait to do more testing. And, so he got admitted. Neri stayed overnight with him because he couldn't move, so she had to sort of roll him every 45 minutes. Because when we sleep, we roll, we move, even though we're asleep and we don't know, but when you lose function, you can't do that. So, so started our journey, and Aussie's little medical journey. So I drove home. I probably got home at, I don't know, early hours of the morning. But you can't sleep. Of course, your mind's racing.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, it's...
being a dad, mate, it's... I heard somebody say it the other day. It's like... if somebody goes to shoot your wife, you think for a second, you go, no, shoot me. It's like when you're a father and it's to your children, there's no hesitation. Like, not that I would hesitate with Laura, if you're listening, but it's with your children, the DNA is like you would so easily give your life for theirs. It's so overwhelmingly powerful. And when I hear that story and feel your anguish, even in the way you tell it, it's like, it's so relatable. You're like, just take my life for this kid. Yeah. You know, what's going on? And so, you know, he's 13 at the time.
Yeah, he was 13,
And so they've said that are they still calling it a stroke now? Like, I mean, it's 18 months on.
Yes.
Yeah. How does that come on with that 13-year-old boy?
Yeah, I've never heard. Question. They did so much testing. And it's funny what you talked about. You have all of those thoughts.
Mm.
And you think, you know, as a professional athlete for 25 years, all the things you've learned about behavior and routines and habits and mindset would help. It probably would have helped if it was me in the bed. But when it's your child, you just feel 100%. Guilty. You just think, well, why? And I used to say, I wish it was me instead of you. And he would say, he was always so strong and had a great attitude. He said, no, you wouldn't want to be here, Dad. It's okay. And we had every test done. We had the MRI 24 hours post, and it showed up what they thought it would, which was dead tissue on his spinal cord. You know, most levels of the spine are supplied by more than one artery, but certain levels only have one artery, apparently. And I think, unfortunately, that's where he got the clot. So, yeah, they did all the testing. They tested everything, hematology, rheumatology, autoimmune responses, everything.
Wow.
But when the history was taken and when we were, like, in the first few hours after he had the stroke, we worked out that the day before at school he was running to his locker room with his mates, like he did every day after the bell went, had his backpack on, and he jumped down this little flight of stairs and sort of landed awkwardly and sort of hyperextended his back in an awkward way. But didn't even mention it. Didn't mention it that night when he got home from school, or it was just the next day. I think it was the first time he mentioned it was when we were driving to the hospital, and I was trying to come up with things to say. And I think I said to him something like, mate, have you ever had, because he said it was a strange pain when he collapsed. Yeah. And when we're in the car driving to the hospital, I said, have you ever felt a pain like that before? And he said, yeah, actually, I felt it yesterday. The only other time I felt it. And I'm like, yesterday? What happened yesterday? And that's when we heard about the little jumping down the stairs. And
which we've all done at 13. You're always jumping down stairs and
freakish. Situation where, and the way the body's designed, your skeletal system is kind of like your armor. It protects the organs and the arteries and the nerves. And if you think of the vertebral column with the spinous processes, it's meant to protect everything. And it does normally. But as you're growing, arteries and nerves are in different positions. And perhaps just one of the hyperextension, it just crimped or clipped an artery. That's what they think happened and caused a tearing in the lining of an artery, which formed a clot as it tried to heal itself. And then when he ran the next day, the high pressure flicked the clot off and it blocked. And it was a transient or a temporary blockage by the time they got blood thinners to him. And in the beginning that he was on, he was on four intravenous drips for weeks. I mean, he had,
jeez, really? I was going to ask the journey from that moment on.
Yeah, it was, it's crazy. You go from athletics carnival.
So, athletics carnival, running at the GPS, for people that don't know, it's a big deal. It's your 13-year-old kid running for Newington, big deal. Mate.
And then 12 hours later, we're at the hospital, and I mean, 24 hours later, we were having conversations that they didn't know if he'd ever walk again. In fact,
were you worried about his life at any point?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. I think you do. I think you try to stay positive, but as things progress and this level of dysfunction is moving up, and Neri and I sitting there thinking, well, when's it going to stop? I mean, how high is this thing going to go? I think they got it under control quickly, though. I mean, we had great doctors and nurses, and by the time we took the second MRI, and we could see what we were now dealing with. We could see the damaged tissue and the dead tissue on his spinal cord. It became apparent what levels were impacted. It was sort of level L2, L4, and then L8, L12.
Wow.
Thoracic levels, sorry, not lumbar levels. Yeah, thoracic levels. So
still, mate, that's a lot. And
yeah, it is a lot. And we weren't sure what, I mean, so many things too. You have so many things in your body that you don't even know. Like we weren't exactly sure what was due to the lack of blood, and that's certain things and things can show up on imaging that you may have your whole life and not know unless something happens. I mean, people have incidental findings, medical findings all the time. They go in for some sort of CT scan and cancer shows up, or so you don't. I mean, there's so many things going on in our body, so we don't know what was a direct result of the stroke, but it looked like sort of that thoracic level 8 to 12 was the main level impacted. And you know, I sort of went into this period where I didn't really want to know the specifics of it. At that point, I just wanted to know what it meant and then what we could do about it.
What are my action steps forward, right? Yeah. I mean, you have the initial shock, and that shock must have been terrifying.
Yeah, it was. And then, it was. Yeah. And, you know, I think – so I got home 3 a.m, started reading the old textbooks and doing Google searches, and I came back in at 7. And, you know, Neri was amazing. I mean, she's worked in emergency nursing for nearly 3 decades. I know when it's your own child, it's a lot different. I mean, she told me that. But I've walked in, can't remember if it was the Sunday now or the next day, Monday. So we just went into straight into shift. She would stay from 8 at night till 8 in the morning. And then I'd come in from 8 in the morning until 8 at night. So he had someone with him all the time. And that was our routine.
How long was that for?
Probably the next, probably while he was in hospital, 8 weeks.
8 weeks?
Yeah. So initially that first week, yeah, we sat down with the neurologist and he said, this is what's happened. We don't know exactly what's caused it. This is my best guess. Because I said to him, give me your best guess. What, you know, it would be nice for me to know what caused it in these early stages because, and Neri was the same. Is there any suggestion it may happen again, or like what is, so they were certainly some of our thoughts in the beginning, like yes, what has caused it, but could it happen again? More importantly, that I guess that's what we were more worried about. They were doing so much testing, but moving forward, he said, this is what I think it means. I mean, he's impacted, his motor function and sensory functions impacted, what we think will be permanently. So yeah, it wasn't a great prognosis moving forward. And there's so many unknowns, and they just sort of outline what it is that we can see right now and what that may mean. So it looked like potentially we would be maybe in hospital for 6 months, and then he may have to go into a rehab facility after that. So these are the things that are being outlined. As the days and weeks are going on, this is what became apparent. We weren't sure if he would ever walk again. And right now he has no movement from the chest down. So it was kind of a waiting game. I think it was the second day on the Monday I came back in, got back in at 8 a.m. And, Neri just met me out in the hall as I came in. And she said, we've just got to be positive. And he had text messaged me actually saying, still get emotional.
Little buddy, take a break.
Yeah, no, it's good. It's good. I'm good. I haven't sort of relived the early days for a while. But, he text messaged me saying, can you bring in some stretch cords and hand dumbbells? Apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
No, I've got to keep moving, Dad.
Yeah, so that's
what I can.
I brought in some stuff and then Neri just said, we got to be positive. So I walked in the room. They had music playing. He was watching English Premier League football highlights, which he loves. He loves his English Premier League. And, yeah, that was, I guess, the start of our journey. And he was always super positive. He's such a good kid. Neri was amazing. She was right at, I don't want to say she was at home, but
she was trained in this area, mate.
Yeah.
She was trained in this area. This is what she does. And Neri, who I know, you know, incredibly well, I think I've known Neri almost longer than I've known you, but
yeah,
she's a strong country woman who's worked in this field. And it's, I mean, I'm sure the two of you together and the strength and the resilience that you both have, because even you and all the trials and things that you've been through in your own athletic career, you've also learned to adapt and be resilient. I think one of the great things about being a professional athlete is the fact that you learn to adapt quickly.
Yeah.
Under duress. And so for you to go through experiences like this, like we did with when Sydney got bitten by the rattlesnake and we thought she was gone, it's like this whole parenting thing is brutal.
Yeah.
And it's like, and it's frightening and it's scary and it's hard. And then you just, you know, you start doing all the deep breathing and the, okay, what can I do? How do I act to go forward here? You know, everything that you've kind of learned and everything you have in your tool belt.
You're going to autopilot for sure. And
yeah.
I mean, I tell you what, things get put in perspective pretty quickly though, because you're in a hospital that's bursting at the seams with sick children and their families. You're not there on your own. There are a lot of families, and you see very quickly, yeah, a lot of them are worse off than you. And, you know, that was amazing insight that Ozzy had from the start. He used to say to us, oh, there's some sick kids in here. You know, and I would be thinking, oh, you're one of them, buddy. But I thought it was an interesting mindset that he had. And but yeah, that was day one of the journey. And you know, there were a lot of, I think, parallels to sport though, because I mean, even the neurologist, you know, he said, I think this was on day two or day three, he said, you know, stroke rehabilitation is like endurance training. It's about repetition and consistency. And that was the first time I sort of thought, okay, well, that's something, because I felt like a fish out of water in the hospital. I thought, well, that's something I know. That's good to know. I think I can help. There's something I can help with then. So, but yeah, I guess fast forward. I mean, we had a lot going on that week because Lucy was about to start her HSC. So you've got two other daughters at home, yeah. So on the Wednesday, so about 4 days after, 5 days after he'd suffered the stroke, Neri and I got ready. Lucy had a graduation dinner. So we just got ready in the hospital room and drove over. And it's hard, you know, because you don't want to leave the hospital, but you also have other children. And I got some great advice from a friend who said you've got to be there for those occasions, for as much as everyone will be there celebrating all the other kids and the families. You've got to go, and I didn't want to go. Neri's like, we're going, and I'm glad we did go. And in the circumstances, it was good to be around other people, and everyone knew what was going on and they were supportive. But we had a good night and we celebrated a group of girls who had come to the end of their high school journey, and it was a big milestone in their lives. There was a lot going on. But what we also had a great milestone that week, that Austin wiggled one of his toes.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was amazing. Yeah, it might have even been the morning of the graduation dinner that night or the next morning, but I was at home there. He was at the hospital. My mum had driven down from Coffs Harbour to stay with us, and I was in the mornings. I just developed this routine. I was just trying to walk Lani to school, so I would walk her to school, and then I would drive to the hospital, and I would put the phone down actually, and try and just be present with Lani. So we'd walk to school. My phone was actually beeping, and so I'd missed a few calls and things, and I thought I'll get to it. So I put the phone down and I walked Lani up to school and back, and then when I got back, I checked, and it was Ozzy actually. He'd sent me a video of him wiggling his left toe. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And because at the time we'd got him into the hyperbaric, through Neri's connections, we got Ozzy into the hyperbaric chamber 30 hours after he suffered the stroke. So we were sitting there, long story short, I think you'll enjoy this part of the story though. We were sitting there on the Sunday. Ozzy had the stroke the day before. We were running through all the things we can do in terms of treatment protocols, what options are available. And he was on the medicines he could be on. He was on steroids and immunoglobulins and blood thinners. But Neri's an avid consumer of podcasts, which you'll be glad to hear. And she had recently listened to a podcast of a professor who she used to work with 20 years prior at St. George Hospital, and he was a professor of hyperbaric medicine. And she messaged one of her girlfriends who she'd nursed with for ideas as well. And Megan had got back to her and said, you need to reach out to one of my best friends who's a neurologist in Perth, which we did. And this doctor got back to us straight away on a Sunday, and she said, get him in the hyperbaric chamber. And then the penny dropped in there because she'd listened to the podcast about the hyperbaric chamber. Mm-hmm. So she messaged the doctor who she knew, and he said, yeah, it's definitely an option. And coincidentally, he was working at the adults hospital next door. So we're at the children's hospital at Randwick, and there's an adults hospital next door. And even though they're next door to each other, they're actually separate hospitals.
Okay.
But he said, yeah, you need to get him in, and you need to get him in as soon as possible. So we called our neurologist in, and he's a great man, Dr. Hugo Sampaio. He came in. It was a Sunday. He came in, and we asked him about, because he had said to us, he knew Neri's background in the medical field, and he said, you know, you're going to have people reaching out to you from all over the world with ideas. And he said, bring them all to me. He said, I'm open to everything. We will evaluate them on a case-by-case basis, and things that we think are appropriate and that we can implement, we will, and that are safe. Of course, they're not going to try anything experimental, but so he had like a 90-minute conference call with this professor, and they worked out there were no contraindications, there were no real risk factors other than him being on blood thinners, his eardrums could burst, that's about it, but we could control for that, so, or plan for that. So, yeah, the doctor walked in and said, we got a decision to make. If we want to get him in the hyperbaric chamber tonight, we've got to make a decision in the next 30 minutes. And Neri had gone home. So I got Neri on the phone, and we were just sitting there. And we ultimately, we gave the decision. We said to Austin, this is your life, mate, and your body. It's your decision. And he's a smart kid. Ozzy's a really, really intelligent kid.
Yeah.
And he would see when the doctors and nurses were conversing outside the room, and with Neri and I, we'd come in and he'd say, well, what are they saying? So we from the start, we said to the doctors, nurses, let's have the conversations in front of Austin. He's old enough and mature enough, and I think it gave him a level of control in this thing that was maybe he felt was out of control. And so he made a lot of the decisions, and he would say to Neri and I, what do you think? And with the hyperbaric one, I said, mate, I don't know. And he ended up saying, if there's even 1% chance that it makes a difference, I want to do it. I want to do it. So he went in the hyperbaric chamber that night, about 2 hours later, and it's a 90-minute session where you're in the hyperbaric. So the adults hospital next door has the second biggest hyperbaric chamber in the world.
Oh, wow.
And they mainly use it for divers who get the bends and other – other medical conditions of poor circulation, so more elderly patients who have had diabetes or things of really poor circulation. So all these, this is just driving oxygen into your body at a high pressure. And I think the highest pressure is the equivalent of 18 meters below sea level, whatever the pascals or the megapascals are. I forget what the measuring equivalent was, but... Yeah, so we got in, and he ended up having 2 weeks. That was the protocol, 2 weeks. And the reason I tell that story is because some of the doctors were reluctant at the hyperbaric chamber to use it on this, and they had said unless there's any improvement, noticeable improvement after a couple of days, we're going to stop the hyperbaric treatment. So that Austin moving his toe and getting that video we sent to the doctors, that got him 15 sessions in the hyperbaric chamber. And
What did you see after that, after 15? Was there more improvement? Did you get?
After every, so that first day where he wiggled his toe, then the next day he wiggled the toe on the right side, and then it was an ankle. So there was something each day, Yeah.
Wow.
And we were going hard on the rehab. I think the doctor, everyone thought we were crazy, but.
Well, that's the thing, you felt comfortable, and it's like, okay.
Well, yeah, I know.
Watch out, Dad's coming through.
Yeah, and once, and Neri was all for that too. I mean, one thing I remember from my physio days was this idea of use it or lose it. That's what they used to say. Yeah. And I guess that was more designed for later in life.
Yeah, elderly patients, of course.
Elderly patients, use it or lose it. But I kind of thought, well, these things, let's reinforce these pathways that are still moving and help them grow. And it was amazing. It's amazing that when you move uninhibited in a normal way, you don't think anything of it. But when you have to relearn everything from scratch,
wow.
They have scales of motor function. You know, can you move it unassisted? Do you need assistance? Can you move it against gravity? That's a big one, because you can often move it in a bed, but then can you move it against gravity? So when you just walk around your everyday life moving, you take for granted the different levels, and there's however many steps you have to check off before that happens. And we don't think of it, because that happens to us when we're babies, when you're developing normally. But, yeah, we went through all of that. The rehab in Aussie was, man, he was getting stuck into 4 rehab sessions a day really quick. We had 2 scheduled rehab sessions, and we just set up a gym in his room. We were doing 2. And by now, so after, I guess, the medical emergency had long passed. That was sort of after the first week. They were quite confident that what had happened, whatever abnormal process had occurred inside his body, had stopped. And now we were into the rehab phase. So, yeah, that became the journey then. It was about rehabilitation. And I remember the second weekend we were in there was the October long weekend. So there was no medical staff. Well, there was the bare minimum medical staff, but you didn't have all the extra therapy. But I just rang a mate of mine who's an incredible exercise physiologist, and he just drove in with a box full of equipment, medicine balls and different things. We just set up a gym in Aussie's room. We had stretch cords and, we were doing the rehab. So, yeah,
that's awesome.
Austin was very – he had an athlete's mentality, that's for sure.
Where is he at now, mate? Let's fast forward 18 months in terms of movement and give me a rundown. How's he moving?
Well, it was 18 months in March. So what they say to you is that there's not a lot of precedence. There's not a lot of stroke, teenage stroke patients.
Mm.
So there's not a lot of that you can defer back to in terms of what treatments worked or didn't work, also what outcomes they end up with. So I think when we had the last medical checkup, I mean, they love Aussie. They were calling him the miracle man. They are over the moon with the level of function that he's been able to regain. Of course, Austin wants to get back to where he was. That's his benchmark. And I always try and adjust my goals around what he wants, which is hard, because sometimes we project our own thinking into others. And I know that's what I did with Austin. So Neri's had to remind me that I have to, you know, step back a little bit, and which I do, and just try and enable and assist. But I've got to say, he drives it. He does. I know when we're in hospital in the beginning, a lot of the rehab therapists were thinking that it was Neri and I, and we're like, no, this is him. This is all Austin's doing. And, you know, we know that from being athletes for over 2 decades, right? Nothing happens unless
it has to come from the individual. No coach can coach an athlete. If, you know, a great coach actually is trying to stop an athlete from overdoing it.
Right? Yeah, just keeping them, just finessing them and keeping
them in the field of play.
Yeah.
And so is he walking now?
Yeah, he's walking. So he walked out of the hospital after.
He walked out of the hospital.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. We were discharged with a wheelchair, and he was meant to be in the wheelchair most of the time. But he walked out. We got photos of him walking out, pushing his own wheelchair with all his gear in it. He went back to school with the wheelchair. His school were incredible.
Really? Oh, that's great to hear, mate. It's my old school.
Yeah. And look, they had said to us, there's no rush in getting him back to school. But a big part of recovery for anyone, but I think especially a kid, is the mental part of it. And they just want to feel normal. They want to be back doing the things. And it's ironic that when you're a kid, you don't want to go to school, but in that sort of situation, he couldn't wait to get back to school, and the school facilitated and made that happen. 95% of his school is wheelchair accessible, but they moved all his classrooms onto the ground floors, and But he was, he had his balance and everything was way off. So we weren't putting him on the bus or public transport. I drove him to and from school every day. And then once he got in the school grounds, he had a lot of assistance, the school nurse, and it was great. We saw his mental state, which was already in a good place. He's such a positive kid, just go up into another stratosphere, being back around his mates. Got back
the power of the mind, mate. The power of the mind. I'm telling you, more and more I lean into this, you know, and people get tired of me talking about it on the show, but the practice of gratitude every single morning. I go out and ground myself barefoot, you know, even hug a tree, dare I say it. But it is all about grounding. And then I practice all my gratitude. Now, for a lot of people, that's prayer. For me, it's gratitude. And it's amazing when you get used to this gratitude practice and the massive slap of perspective you get. Like on the wall, you know, it starts with, I got fresh air, running water, electricity, roof of my head, boom, boom, boom. And you start going through the list. And it only takes me 5-10 minutes to do it all. But then also layering in and you as an athlete would understand this. And it's not forced visualizing or manifesting. It's more, I've spent a lot of time more recently, this last 6 to 12 months, in just visualizing and manifesting in a way as though I already have it. So even, you know, one of our kids has some stuff that we're dealing with on a constant basis. And so rather than wanting for improvement, I mention it, I'm so grateful that these boxes are all ticked and things are moving in line, right? And it's more of, it's actually happening rather than I want for. And that's been huge for me in terms of the mental sort of side of things. And it's amazing how the universe, how God, whatever you want to call it, cooperate. I don't know. It's been fascinating for me. I don't know if you guys have leaned into that a little bit more. Or
I think whatever it is, you say it might be religion, prayer, practicing gratitude, whatever it is that gets you in that mental place is a good thing. I mean, that's the final frontier of performance. And performance, by performance, I don't just mean winning races or having a successful business. I mean, life performance, that's the control center. It's our control center. And if your thought processes and your understanding of the world and the way you interact with it is improved and you have a greater self-awareness, I think that leads to a greater awareness of the people around you and a greater interaction and a greater life. So no, I'm a big believer in that. If I had my time again, I could go back and study, I would study psychology. I just think it's the final frontier of everything, understanding ourselves. And, to your question of where is that, he's going well. I mean, he's not back to high level sport.
Did I see him surfing on his 15th birthday a few days ago?
Yeah.
I saw it on your Instagram.
That is a huge milestone because, you know, when something happens to you, the experts, and we have so many smart people in this world, doctors, professors, and we're lucky. And part of their greatness, I think, is not only that they're individually smart, they know to collaborate. You know, great people don't hold knowledge to themselves. They share it and they're always trying to learn more. So this medical fraternity reach out when there's a strange case study. And so what they do is they look at and compare pathology on MRI. Is there something out there that's similar to this? Mm-hmm. And if there is, what worked for it? What was the outcome? How can we strategize around that? And what we found was that there was one or two teenage stroke patients, but there were the two stroke patients that we found who had a very similar, pathology to Ozzy. I think pathology is the right word, and they were surfers. And it happened while they were surfing. And so our neurologist, Dr. Sampaio, had said it's strange that I know Austin's a surfer, but he hadn't surfed for 3 months or 2 months. Mm. Like he hadn't surfed when he had the stroke. The other two were surfing when it happened.
Gotcha.
But it gathered momentum, this thing where they'd given this thing a name. It was called surfer's myelopathy. So that actually, that something to do with the repetitive hyperextension and then taking off on a surfboard and the sudden drop in blood pressure. They weren't sure. They were hypothesizing. There were no studies done. But he said to me, it's an interesting causation there. Like, it's something we can't ignore. I don't know if there's, it might have nothing to do with it, but so was surfing was something, because you can imagine in all the rehab meetings, they're asking Austin what he wants to do. And they're thinking more the immediate term, day to day, week to week. Like, we want to get you up out of bed. We want to get you, they would say, what do you want to do, Austin? He'd say, I want to surf. So they're thinking of knee flexion extension. Let's get to full range. And he said, I want to surf.
Yeah.
So
where's the destination? I need to know the destination before I can do the steps in between.
Yeah.
I'm a destination person. I'm exactly like Austin. I can't work the day to day unless I know the destination I'm actually wanting to go to. I love it. That's so cool.
Yeah, that's what he'd say. So I want to get back to high level football. I want to surf and I want to.
That's awesome.
So anyway, the doctor had said to me on the quiet, I don't know if you guys will ever be surfing again. Obviously, the takes a lot of function, high level function and balance. And but you know, we got back to it last October. So 13 months after his stroke, I had said to Neri,
wow.
I had asked the doctors as well, and they give you their best opinion, but it's based on they hadn't had any teenage stroke patients. And, you know, Neri said an interesting thing. She said, you know, every barrier we've come up against or level that we now need to take a leap of faith to go to the next level, there's an element of risk in the unknown there, because, you know, he's going to have falls. There's going to be things that happen, but do you stop the progression and the rehabilitation because of that, or do you just do your best to mitigate all the risks and do the best rehab to prepare yourself, just like being an athlete again? And yeah, so each step that's how we try to approach it. And I must say, I was very nervous paddling out with him for the first time, but we picked a surf break that was known for being a real gentle wave. And he'd been out swimming in the surf for months by then anyway, much to the doctor's
dismay. What are you
displeasure,
doing?
But, you know, you can't stop living. So, yeah, we paddled out, and Greg, I tell you, it was amazing. The first wave he paddled, he just took off on it. We practiced a few pop-ups and takeoffs on the beach, and, yeah, his pop-up wasn't as crisp and as sharp as it had been, but we hadn't surfed.
Wow.
18 months by that point, and because obviously you'd had the stroke 13 months before, but yeah, and each
what
day
a celebration though, mate.
It was, and he got better every single day. I could see his body making adjustments in real time. Every single wave, his pop-up was getting better, his balance, and I think it's, you know, it's one thing to be in a gym doing rehab where, you know, someone's moving you around or you have to do something, a set of so many whatevers, or your balance is being challenged, but to do it in the real world, I mean, every wave is different, right? So you have to adapt and adjust in real time to things that are happening in your environment. And that's, you know,
you're in nature, mate, too. Nature's throwing you whatever it's got.
Yeah.
That is what a celebration. Almost makes me tear up just thinking about how good that must have felt. Mm. You know, every one of these little victories along the way, just, you know, from that moment of you know, you've painted quite the picture. You know, I'm visualizing all of it. How do you, when you look at you, how do you think this whole experience has changed you in any way?
I think I always had good perspective, but I think it brings things into sharper focus of what's really important. And it's a cliche to say it, but you know, I remember those days in the hospital and some mornings just thinking, if he can ever walk again, I'll be doing cartwheels for the rest of my life. just little things like that. And it happened. He made it happen. I guess we were lucky with the extent of the injury, but also lucky with how hard he worked. I have no doubt that his just drive with his rehabilitation. I feel very lucky that through Neri's medical contacts, we were able to access the hyperbaric chamber and some of the best medical professionals in Sydney and in Australia. Neri's medical contacts were invaluable. We were getting just expert advice from everywhere. And how it's impacted me. Yeah, I mean, I think it just, I celebrate little things in life, mate. It's funny being an athlete for 2.5 decades, 25 years. Sometimes you don't see the forest for the trees. You're focused right on what's in front of you. This next training session, this next KPI that I need to hit. You're not even thinking the next race. You're not even thinking that far ahead. It's right now. What do I need to do? And then once you've checked that box, it's the next 5 or 10 seconds. And you move through your life 5 or 10 seconds at a time. And the months and years go past. And I think it's a way of thinking that serves you well in that arena. But yeah, I think it's changed about to just take a step back and look at the big picture now. I just look forward to family time at home, which I always did, to be honest. But
yeah, you've always been a family man. You've been
I enjoy family time at home. Like those occasions when, you're all at home having dinner, which become fewer and fewer as your kids get older in sport, they're off on different nights and doing different things. And, those mornings you're at home all having breakfast together. So I just look forward to those sorts of occasions. And, it put the brakes on me because I went from racing and setting up different businesses, getting involved in different things. And then we hit the pandemic. So that was a handbrake that came on first, which was kind of, it was when we went into that first lockdown, it was the first year I didn't travel in 27 years, which, to be honest, I was sad for everything that was going on in the world and the people who were having a hard time, but I didn't mind being at home with the family, with the kids, spending summer. Neri, being an emergency nurse, went from part-time to overtime.
Yeah, like she was gone. I remember chatting to you. You were home with the kids a lot. Yeah, daddy daycare. Obviously your kids are older than that, but yeah.
Yeah, so moving through the pandemic, then into this situation with us, and that's been our family's journey. And, we had two other daughters that I haven't really talked about much, but, of course, Neri and I were at great pains to make sure that they felt supported and loved, and those things are important. You hear stories all the time about, family gets, sideswiped with something. You get thrown a curveball, and most families do at a different time, and you got to deal with it. But, you've got more often if you've got more than one child, you've got to make sure that, you're still engaged with what's going on in everybody's life. So I think we've tried to do that. So, but yeah, that's been our journey. It's been 18 months. And, from a neurological perspective, they say you have a window of 18 months to 2 years, or that's what they think when post spinal cord injury, that's when your body's most receptive to recovery. So that's why you really make it a focus or a focal point to go hard with the rehab in that time frame. So we're, September this year we'll be at the 2 year mark post injury. And
have your community and friends and family, been supportive? I mean, obviously the doctors and nurses, but the world of triathlon, I mean, I don't know how much of the world of triathlon knows what you've been going through, but
Yeah, we, and that's where you see, they talk about the necessities for a happy life, and one of them is connection, human connection. And I mean, sometimes as an athlete in an individual sport, like I think we got a bit of that with our training, and we tried to socialize in and around the racing, and we stay in touch even though we're all over the world, a lot of our racing generation. But our immediate family and friends were just, mate, they showed up for us big. There'd be times, my shift or stint at the hospital would end. Neri would come back in and she'd be staying overnight. I'd drive home and my mum was at home with the other two girls. But I'd arrive home and there were dinners on our doorstep, friends dropping lasagnas and spaghetti bolognese and things around. People were ordering meals to show up. I had a lot of friends ringing just to check in on Neri and I each day as well. Our immediate support network showed up big for us, and you need it in those, and it's good to feel, I think, practically and logistically, but also just emotionally, to know you got people there who have your back. And all Austin's communities, his schooling community, mate, they were huge for us. his soccer team, his AFL team. And for those who listen in the US or Europe, AFL is the other Australian football. So Aussie used to play Aussie rules. His surf club, Allura Surf Club, they showed up big for us too. So we were very lucky. And, you know, we're very entrenched in all those communities. I still coach the Lillipilli, Aussie soccer team. And he's back to soccer. Things are going good. I mean, you know, I always evaluate from the level he was at.
Yeah.
But sometimes I also need to check myself and say, well, from where he's come from, we're playing with house money. We're going really well. So.
Oh, mate, I can't tell you how grateful I am for you to come on the show and just – well, the show, really, chatting with me and just tell me the story, mate. I know, you know, we Instagram DM'd a little bit through that period, the first 6 months or so. And, you know, I never actually knew how much other people knew about it. You know, you always see you with your training camps in Mallorca or, you know, coaching and bits and pieces. And, you know, even for anybody listening to this story, like, I feel like I was saying this to Laura this morning. I feel like to live means to suffer. And a life with no suffering is not such a thing. There is no such thing. And that's, these things happen and they happen fast and they're traumatic, and how we react to them and adapt. And I keep saying to Laura, we're far more adaptive and resilient than anybody's going to give us credit for. Whether it be the media, politics, medicine, the human spirit and who we are is so much more adaptive and resilient. And you guys as a family are certainly an inspiration on that front. Truly. It's a really great story, mate. I appreciate you opening up and sharing it. Really.
Mate, it's interesting you say that. I mean, firstly, there were so many families that are an inspiration. We were one of hundreds of families in there. Mm. Having healthy kids is a blessing when you see what goes on in those hospitals. But to your point of what you just said, you know, there was little signs and things up around the hospital. And one that I used to read a lot, someone had printed it off on an A4 bit of paper and stuck it up on the wall, and it said, if you're standing here reading this right now and you're doing it tough, rest assured you have everything you need to make it through. So to your point about having to adapt and just push on. And yeah, I mean, in the end, you have no other choice. I mean, something hits you and it hits you hard. And I was very lucky that my wife is just amazing and strong and positive. And you know, a lot of people used to say, oh, Austin, he must be like you, you know, obviously from coming from the athlete point of view. And I used to think, oh, he's got a lot of his mum's mental toughness. There is, you know, what the first responders and the healthcare professionals have to deal with, you know, I'm in awe of. And you talk about people having to respond quickly and deal with hard things and just get on with it. You know, that's what they've got in spades. So, yeah, we were lucky and that was our journey, and it continues, and every family is on its own journey. So,
100%, mate.
Yeah.
Like you said, having children that are healthy, it's a blessing, mate. And I'm like, just take me out, please. Leave my kids alone.
Yeah.
I've had my time. It's been great. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm a dad. I want to hang out, but, you know, please don't make them suffer. But, mate, this has been really fantastic. Thanks for coming on and chatting and sharing the story. I know I thought we might do a little bit of triathlon stuff, but this was far more impactful and just a really great story to share. So, buddy, thanks for, you know, getting up early and sharing that with me. Really appreciate it.
Well, I mean, when, you know, we've talked triathlon a lot and it's been our lives, but our lives have diverged to other things now. And when you sent me the message saying, I'd love you to come on and talk about what you've been up to, I thought that's probably the main thing that's occupied our minds and our consciousness for the past 18 months. So, I always say to Austin, do you mind if I talk? I told him this morning, he headed off to school. I said, do you mind if I talk about you with Greg? He said, no, not at all. And I mean, actually yesterday we were invited back to the Children's Hospital at Randwick. They've built a new part to the hospital, and it was a kind of a important day yesterday because it's 12 or 15 stories high, however high it is. But when they get to the maximum height of the new construction, that's kind of like a momentous day in the building. And now they just have to enclose it and obviously outfit the inside of it, which is no small task. But apparently in the building world, when you get to the maximum height of a project, that's something to celebrate. So the hospital was celebrating and they invited us back. They invited a couple of past patients back, and Ozzy was one of them. So he was on the news last night, Channel 7.
Was he
wearing
really?
Wearing his little hard hat and his high vis vest on the construction site. Yeah, Neri and I were in there with him too. So
when
people
awesome.
Know about it, it's one of those things, you know, you talked about who knows and who doesn't know. And I think it's not one of those things that you publicize. It's also when you immediately you're in the midst of everything that's going on, you just, you know, your time and thoughts are occupied by other things. So, but our close friends knew, and our immediate circle, and then, yeah.
Mate. Well, look, hugs to you and Neri, to Austin, Lunny and Lucy as well. You guys are a dynamite family. You know, we put you up on a pedestal. We think you guys are pretty awesome. I hope we'll be down in Australia June, July. Yeah. So I know we just missed each other last year when I was down, but this year we'll definitely connect, and, you know, either I'll come down to you from, I'll go across the bridge from the North Shore to the South. I don't know. We'll see, mate. It's treacherous over that side, isn't it?
No, it's but hey, we've been heading north quite a bit. We've been getting over to the north side and also into the city. So.
Yeah,
we should. We'll have a family meet up in the city.
100%. You got to meet my little rapscallion kids. They're more American now than Australian. I need to get the Australian back into them. Oh dear. All right, buddy. Well, this has been great. Thanks again. Don't hang up. I'll chat to you in a little bit. For everybody listening, you can find all the show notes and everything else at bennettendurance.com/media. Cheers.